Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Okay, so it wasn't just the three-point jump shots. Connecticut had an awesome defense that prevented Kentucky from playing their inside game. I saw that. That justifies smashing up the campus, doesn't it? It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter. And maybe you're using his new social media question and answer site, Jelly, which he says is designed not just to provide answers, but to increase empathy in the world. Can that really happen? And Biz Stone has a new book called Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. Biz Stone, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks, Brian. I appreciate you having me.
And listeners, you can call, post to our comments page, or tweet any questions for Biz Stone right now. Tweet at Brian Lehrer. Use the hashtag AskBiz, and maybe we'll increase global empathy along the way. Who knows? And seriously, let me jump in right at that conceptual level, because you write in the book that the real reason humanity has become so hyperconnected is not about playing games or keeping tabs on friends. The true promise of a connected society is people helping one another, your sentence. So is that the sentimental view of someone who's already made your digital fortune, or did you have that in mind the whole time when you conceived of Twitter and other early things that you've done?
I wouldn't say that I had it in mind the whole time. It's more of a – there's an author named Steven Johnson, and he writes about something called the slow hunch. It's this concept that there's something in the back of your brain sort of the whole time you're working, and it doesn't really come out and sort of reveal itself to you until many, many years later. So I would say that maybe in the back of my mind all this time, yes. But it wasn't until I left day-to-day operations at Twitter and began kind of noodling around and thinking about things, getting a little bit less, a little less boots on the ground and a little bit more philosophical about things, did I realize that perhaps all of this is headed in a direction for a reason bigger than the sum of its parts.
And along these lines, you write that Jelly, your new Q&A social media site, is less about helping the askers get information than it is about helping the answerers get an empathy fix. Is it really?
Actually, the numbers show that to be true. There's far more people willing to answer questions than there are people willing to ask. Where we're constrained is the number of questions coming in. So you'd think it would be the other way around. You'd think that people would just ask a question and not get an answer. But in fact, you're more likely to get an answer than you are to get a question on the system. And that's because people are just wired to help. We're wired to help other people. And the only reason we don't do it is because pulling over on the side of the freeway and helping someone change a tire, that's a whole difficult thing. And we make excuses for not doing it, like the guy might be crazy, they probably have AAA, they probably already called a friend. If I stop, I'll just be a nuisance. But if we create a system that just lets you tap on, a piece of glass you're holding in your hand, your smartphone, and answer the question or forward it to somebody who might know, I mean, that's you're being no less helpful in some cases, and you're getting the reward, you're getting the thank you card, you're getting that feedback loop from another person that says, hey, thank you for thinking of me, thank you for helping me. And that's really important for people to feel that.
Let me read a piece of pushback to this idea from a commenter on TechCrunch who had read your description of Jelly. And in a way, this is a pushback to the larger notion that social media can help connect people across socioeconomic lines and work as a leveler. A writer named Gil Reich asks, in what world does a 14-year-old girl in Florida get a professional answer from an art director? In a world where it's shared by her rich uncle and powerful uncle who has many others trying to do him favors and get his attention, which may be okay, he writes, but don't claim you're doing it in the name of global empathy. He says, if this were really for global empathy, the influential and well-connected networks would be deployed not to help each other, but to answer the questions of those furthest from their networks. Do you struggle with anything like that?
No, I don't struggle with it. And again, I wouldn't say that my main effort here is necessarily global empathy. I think this is an incredible, wonderful side effect of what we're building. What we're building is we've designed a better way to ask a question. And no one's really rethought this system in the last 15 years. No one's completely reimagined the way we get answers to our queries in the last 15 years because everything's been working so good. But we do live in a completely different media landscape now. We all have these connected mobile devices. We're all on social networks. There's the new degree of separation is no longer 6. It's now been marked down to 3.8, so 4 degrees of separation. We live in a whole new world, and so when you reimagine this way we get our answers, the way my co-founder and I did, we came up with this idea that everyone's connected. We should be able to ask one another for the answers to our questions, not just machines.
And by the way, listeners, if you like that idea, stay tuned for our latest edition of Brian Lehrer Advice Roulette. Later this hour, we're going to do a Equal Pay Day edition of Advice Roulette. This is Equal Pay Day with respect to gender disparities in how much people are paid. And we're going to have a Women Callers Ask Other Women Callers Workplace Advice Roulette coming up in about 40 minutes. But right now we continue with Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter and author of a new book, Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. And if you want to talk to Biz Stone, call us up, 212-433-WNYC. We'll read some of the questions that you've been tweeting for him along the way, but our phones are also open, 212-433-9692 on WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. So, Biz, Twitter just turned 8 years old, as I don't have to tell you. And in the book, you give a little prehistory of Twitter, saying that as far back as 2003, you set your RSS reader, for people who don't know, that's the content feed of some sites people followed, to 255 characters. Of course, Twitter is 140. But you said even in 2003, maybe 255 would become a new standard for blogs. Why that number at that time?
Actually, I didn't set it. It was, at the time, RSS reader, I think it was this, they had standardized the summary of what is going to go in the reader at 255 characters. Somebody had picked that, and they went with it. And I thought to myself, maybe in a world, I think this might have even been 2002, but I said maybe in a world later on, I visualized a world where we were all reading these things on I saw my iPod, my first generation iPod, and I thought, why can't I read things on this, little articles, and maybe they'd be better suited if they were shorter. So I just sort of threw that idea out there, which is frequently what I did with my blog back in the day.
So how did you land on 140 characters for Twitter?
So the way we landed on 140 characters is that when we were building Twitter, we wanted tweets to be both consumed and created in their entirety on everything from the lowliest feature phone to the fanciest broadband-connected web browser. And the international limit for text messages is 160 characters. Nowadays, we don't notice it because our smartphones stitch them together, and, yep, and we don't see that. But the limit is 160, and so we were operating within that limit, and we needed, of course, to give room for the author's name. So that meant, okay, 160 minus some number for the author's name. So we actually chose 15 characters for the author's name, and the rest of the 140 for the tweet, which, of course, then leaves 5 characters unused, which is kind of funny, but that's where we got to 140. We just didn't, originally in the prototype, it was 160 minus however long your name was. But then I brought up to Jack that I didn't think that was fair, that my name is 3 letters long, someone else's name might be Jonathan, and then they have less to tweet with, so why don't we just pick a number?
And you're right that you worried, as you were launching, that Twitter would not be useful. Were you concerned that it would just be a platform for trivial content and pointless snark if it was all messages that short?
Well, yeah, at first it just seemed like it was fun. And to be frank, at first that was enough because the company we had just been trying to work on wasn't fun for us. We weren't having fun. We weren't what I call emotionally invested. We didn't use our own product. And so when we started building Twitter, things started to happen right off the bat, even in the prototyping phase. I decided that I had watched enough Bob Vila when I was a kid that I could do a little home improvement on this little house my wife and I had bought in Berkeley. It was a heat wave, and I thought, oh, I'll just rip up the carpeting and reveal the beautiful hardwood floors underneath like they used to do.
This old social media platform.
Yeah, right. And of course, I start ripping up the carpeting, and there's just a subfloor. I've ruined my home. And I get a tweet at the same time from Evan Williams, our other co-founder, and it says, sipping Pinot Noir after a massage in Napa Valley. And I just start laughing out loud at the incongruence of our two, you know, states at this moment. And then I realize I'm laughing out loud. This is fantastic. I'm laughing at something I'm working on. And this is joy, and this is wonderful. And so at first, that's really all I needed to keep going. It wasn't until later that I realized that this platform could be important.
Could be important?
Yeah. Later on, I learned that there was a few little lessons that sort of kind of piqued my interest, but then there was a real watershed moment that told me, without a doubt, that this could be an important platform.
So were you shocked after you created this thing for fun, tweeting that you were sipping pina coladas while getting a massage or whatever you said your partner did? Did you ever imagine that, like, by 2009, a people's revolt in Iran could come to be nicknamed a Twitter revolution? Or was that just beyond your wildest dreams and you were, you know, gobsmacked when it happened?
Oh, it definitely was something that took us by surprise. But again, I had a history of building these large-scale systems where people are allowed to, you know, express themselves and communicate. I started in 1999 with an early blogging network. I went on to work at Google on Blogger. So I had seen what an unrestrained platform for freedom of speech can, you know, what kind of impacts it can have. Except Twitter sort of blew it all away because it was so accessible. The barrier for entry was so low. It definitely really just took us by surprise. We were amazed. We had to just keep reminding ourselves, it's not Twitter. It's not the tools we're building. It's the brave men and women around the world and what they're doing, and they're choosing to use this tool. They would, if we didn't build this tool, they would use some other tool. So we just had to keep reminding ourselves of that.
So one of our followers at Kitson asks you about, quote, USAID's Cuban Twitter, imitation, sincerest form of insurgency, goes that tweet. And for people who don't know about it, this is in today's news. We have the U.S. government planting a social media site in Cuba, being compared to Twitter in its essence, but designed to help track and really foment political opposition to the government there. Are you flattered, outraged, anything by this?
Actually, maybe I would say validated, just because I spent so much time and energy making sure that people understood that Twitter was – the decisions we made at Twitter were not affected by any part of the U.S. government or any other government. I never wanted anyone to think that we were – you know, we had some, like, red phone hotline that we responded to. When we made decisions, we made them because we thought they were the best thing at the time for the people who were using Twitter, not because anyone, emailed us or called us or anything like that. So I always steered clear of any, like, hey, look, come in, you know, we invite you to come, like, to the White House and get photographed with, you know, that's all great, but I didn't want to create this appearance that we were in any way working together.
So are you worried that a U.S.-planted fake Twitter will scare off dissidents from using real Twitter in pursuit of freedom and justice around the world?
No, because I think we built a brand, and I think we've built the goodwill over the last 8 years to that shows that we will always try our best to do what's right for the people who use the service.
212-433-WNYC. And Chris in Hillsborough, you're on WNYC with Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to ask what you think the effect on language, the 140 character limit, has, because I've noticed that grammar has really taken a beating on Twitter.
Well, I mean, my aspiration has always been that constraint would inspire creativity, and that old aphorism of if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter would force people to be more concise and more almost poetic in their communications. That may not be happening, and of course, you know, text messaging in general, people have started to, you know, condense their words and their language. I'm not a fan of it. I use full sentences. I don't abbreviate. I don't use emoticons. I'm sort of an old school guy.
You?
Yeah.
Should we be surprised by that?
I don't know. I started out as an artist. I've written 3 books. I do a lot of writing in my spare time. You know, I think email should start out with hello, person's name, comma, you know, something. They should be short, but they should be, you know, addressed properly.
Because I could argue it the other way, which is that people are communicating with each other via Twitter, via text. People presumably know what each other mean when they text in all those non-traditionally grammatical ways. But then if they have to step back and write a magazine article or something like that, then they're going to have to use regular grammar because that's what that format, that's what that medium requires.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. And then you also, you look at these systems like Snapchat, where people are literally communicating just with photos. I mean, the conversation goes something like this. Photo? Photo! Photo! I mean, this is what, there's no words. They're just sending each other pictures, and they understand what those mean. So maybe you're right. Maybe there is a time and place for every sort of medium and writing, and I'm just too old school here.
Pedro in New Rochelle wants to defend the USAID fake Twitter, I think. Pedro, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that in Cuba there is much demand to exchange information, and that they also use flash memories and CD-ROMs to watch BBC News and other programs that are not accessible to them within Cuba.
Therefore, if the U.S. plants this thing that they can have access to, then much the better, because it enhances freedom in Cuba?
Much, much better, yes.
Pedro, thank you very much.
I do agree that people should have a platform for freedom of speech. I mean, this is what I've dedicated my life to building. But to think that you could build it and that it would create, that the technology would then create a revolution of some kind, is backwards. It's people that do this. And it's people that will find the right tools, like, you know, water finds the ocean. It's all people, and they'll do like what Pedro just said. You know, they'll record the BBC on CD-ROM. They'll share it around. They'll do whatever it takes. So I believe that people will find a way to communicate and build platforms to do such.
212-433-WNYC, our very special guest, Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter. He has a new book called Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. You talked before about, with the influence of Bob Vila, creating Twitter for the simplicity of the platform after you were kind of getting turned off by the bells and whistles of your last project, if I can put those words in your mouth.
Yeah.
Now there's a new Twitter redesign, which seems to have more bells and whistles and emphasis on photos, larger headers and profile pictures, more choice about placing certain tweets at the top of your timeline, all this, you know, kind of fancification maybe. Any reactions? Does it get away from that ultra-simplistic or simple design that it was founded on?
I think as long as the system fails gracefully all the way down to the simplest of feature phones, then everything is headed in the right direction. If you're on if you're using a really fancy computer, you might as well take advantage of the fact. If you're on a phone that can only handle text messages, you know, in a part of the world where you even get internet connectivity, then a tweet is just the right format. So I think it's, you know, depending on the device, that you're on and the connectivity that you have, you may as well take advantage of these things. I mean, people love looking at photos. So by all means, let's share photos.
You use the term fail down.
Yeah, fail gracefully. You know, like the fundamental element of Twitter is still the tweet. Everything is sort of attached to that. You have a tweet, and then you may have all this other, what they refer to as metadata, you know, extra information that rides along with the tweet. But if you only have a phone that can only handle text messages, what you'll get is the tweet and none of the other stuff. If you're if you're using Twitter's Macintosh desktop application, you'll get all of this wonderful other things. But as long as it always sort of fails gracefully down to that lowest common denominator, I think the company is headed in the right direction.
One of our listeners who tweets with the handle Donkey Tails asks, why doesn't Twitter make money?
Twitter makes money through advertising. It just decides to reinvest that money in itself right now. It's not, you know, it's not just building up a giant war chest. It's reinvesting. It's growing. It's, from my perspective, you know, I like to look decades out for this company, because this company just went public. In many ways, it just got its start. Twitter is going to become a timeless company of enduring value, and it should be reinvesting in itself right now. I mean, it's making money, but it needs to grow and build, and there's a lot of work ahead of them.
It did lose money, technically. I looked this up on Mashable today because I wasn't sure. Lost money in 2013 after going public, right?
I don't actually know. I don't work there anymore, and I don't follow the day-to-day. But like I said, I look at this in terms of decades. I mean, you look at a company like Amazon, they often lose money, but they're just an amazing company doing amazing, innovative things. And I don't. It's like when you're trying to lose weight, they say don't look at the scale every day because you'll get disappointed. You got to look at the trend. You know, you have to look at, like, how are you doing over time, and that's the most important thing. Are things moving forward over time? And that's really what you have to look at. You have to take a longer view of a company like this.
You have a chapter in the book called The No Homework Policy, in
yeah.
which you write about deciding in high school that you were too busy to do homework. And you actually announced this to your teachers. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, I just want to make sure people don't, you know, think that this is just some, like, a punk kid getting away with something. I tried really hard.
Because I have a son in high school who I'm not going to allow to read your book now.
I tried really hard. I got to high school. I actually formed a sports team because I wanted to be on a sports team. I founded a lacrosse team. So I had to go to school, go to sports practice, go to work. I had to work. Got home from work around 8 or 9, and then it was time to do this homework. And I'm not particularly fast at solving math problems or even reading history and English chapters. And so I tried for the first 2 weeks of high school to do everything that was expected of me, and it was taking me till 3, 4 a.m. in the morning. And it just wasn't sustainable, and I wasn't going to quit my sports team. I wasn't going to quit my job. So I just decided that I would be very frank and upfront about it. I went to each of my teachers, and I said, I reintroduced myself. So I said, hello, my name is Biz Stone. This is your great teacher. This is a great class. Love it. I just wanted to let you know that I'm not going to be doing my homework. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay attention as best as I can in this class because I know the point of school is to learn. I just can't get the homework done and do everything else. Something has to give. And I sort of universally got laughter from the teachers, I think because it was just, you know, this freshman high school student being so frank about this. I'm instituting a policy here, you know. They told me, first they laughed, then they told me, well, it's going to affect your overall grade. And I told them I'd be willing to accept that because, you know, I just can't do it. And it worked out really well for me. I don't even know that they did affect my grade overall. But the key, I think, was being very upfront about it. And I wanted to make sure I said, look, it's not like I'm troubled. I'm not trying to, like, you know, I'm not being a punk. You know, I'm just, this is how my life works, and something's got to give. And so I was very upfront about it, and it worked for me.
Did you study for tests? Did you write papers? Were those exceptions to the policy?
Yes. When there's a big paper, I would write. Of course, I waited until the last minute, but I would always do the big the big ones. You know, like I did have a class where the entire class was the whole year was to, you have a year to write something, and of course I waited to the day it was due to write it. But you know, but I would do those big things, of course. Yes, study for tests.
And then you dropped out of college. So you and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and do I see a pattern here?
Well, not. I don't think it's for everybody, but you know, I had to make a choice. I had a wonderful scholarship, a full scholarship for excellence in the arts at university, and it, you know, you can't ask for more than that. And I got this job on the side moving heavy boxes for a publishing company, and one day when the art department, the department that does the book covers, they all went out to lunch, and I was good with Max by that time. I snuck onto their Max, where they were just switching over to from spray glue and X-Acto knives. I snuck onto the art director's workstation, designed a jacket, printed it out, matted it up, and put it in the pile to go off for approval in New York City by sales and editorial. And so when the art director came back, he said, who designed the jacket? And I said, me. And he said, the box kid. And at that point, he offered me a job, and I thought, well, don't people go to university so they can qualify for this kind of job? You know, like, won't I be kind of skipping ahead? And also, I said, wouldn't it be much better to sit here like 8-10 hours a day apprenticing with this master art director? Wouldn't I learn that much more? So I decided, I made a big decision to drop out of college and do just that, sort of basically take an apprenticeship. So that is a wonderful way of learning, and it's maybe not for everybody, but for me, it worked perfectly.
So you're for those freshman basketball players going right to the NBA. No, you don't have to go there.
I actually don't. I don't know anything about sports. But
Really? You who created your own lacrosse team? Isn't that what you said?
I only created my own lacrosse team because I didn't know any. I was in this program called Boy Rangers when I was a kid. My mom put me in this program called Boy Rangers. We had to do various feats of strength to advance from papoose to warrior. It was borderline racist, and so I was in this weird program, and which was father son, and of course my father wasn't there, so it was even more awkward. And as a result, I didn't play Pee Wee soccer or Little League or anything like that. So when I got to high school, I thought, well, I should be on a sports team because that seems like a good way to integrate into the social fabric of high school. And I'm naturally athletic. I tried out for these sports, and I just froze because I realized I have no idea what the rules of any of these these things are. So I did a little research, and I discovered that there was no lacrosse team. So I went to the administration, and I said, if I can get enough kids together and a coach, can I form a lacrosse team? And they said, yeah, if you can do that. And so I did. And the thinking was, if none of us know the rules, then if we're all equally clueless, I don't have to be worried about it. And it turns out I was good at it, and the kids voted me captain, and we were a pretty good team. Looking back, of course, I could have just learned the rules of one of the games, but I didn't realize until just now that could have been a way to go.
I think it's a very telling story. It means you were more an entrepreneur and a community organizer than an athlete.
Well, what I learned from that experience, what I realized looking back upon it later was that a powerful lesson about opportunity, and people often they think about opportunity as the way it's defined, which is a set of circumstances that allow for something to happen. And of course you should think about something as the way it's defined. But if you take a step back and you say, okay, well, the circumstances, you don't have to wait around necessarily for those circumstances to emerge. You can be the architect of the circumstances, which I was. So in other words, opportunity can be manufactured. And that was a really powerful lesson for me to transpose into the business world later on in life.
So last thing, and I think it's related, and my guest has been Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter, author now of Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. And one of your big tips to enhance creativity is what you just said, that opportunity can be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
But another one is that great work comes from abandoning a linear way of thinking. So can you give everybody the first three steps to abandoning a linear way of thinking? No, that's a joke. But seriously, what does that mean? What did that look like in your case? How can an individual do that as a matter of choice?
Well, it's all about kind of shaking things up and realizing that creativity is a renewable resource and that you can come at any challenge from, infinitely artful approaches. Nonlinear thinking is this concept of kind of not approaching something head on, coming at it from the side, taking a break and brainstorming about something completely different, and then thinking, is there some way that these things overlap, and is there taking the opportunity to let your mind kind of float out of your body and be heads in the cloud. I mean, this is one of the core great things about the relationship I have with both Evan Williams and Jack Dorsey is that they allow me to be in the clouds. You know, if I ask them during a brainstorming session, hey, Jack, let's just assume gravity doesn't exist, he will immediately say, okay, go on. He's not going to say, he won't shut me down, in other words. And so then I can go on, I can say all these crazy ideas, and then the next day he says, you know what, somewhere in there was something that had some merit, and I want to talk more about it. And this is the way that you can come up with really great stuff. I mean, it's not necessarily, I'm not advocating for quitting your job and, doing a startup. I'm just, in any case.
Biz Stone, congratulations on your success, and thanks a lot for talking to us. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, Brian, thanks so much for having me. I did, too.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll check in with the New York City Comptroller, Scott Stringer. A new report finds a kind of shocking lack of arts classes in some of New York City's public schools. And then, in honor of Equal Pay Day, we will have an edition of Brian Lehrer's show, Advice Roulette, specifically for women to ask other women advice about anything regarding the workplace. So get ready to think of the questions you want to ask of your fellow women worker listeners. As long as you're willing to answer a question from another caller, that'll come up in about 10 minutes. First, Scott Stringer on lack of arts education in the public schools. Stay with us.